Well, good afternoon, everybody.
Good afternoon, John.
My name is John Horrigan. It's a pleasure to be here at Jimmy Steerhouse as we come towards Christmas. And today what I'd like to do is talk about the Christmas Truce. Now, the Christmas Truce took place in Christmas of 1914 during the Great European War, or World War I. And one of the biggest fears of high command during warfare is not peace. It's a term called fraternization. That's where enemies talk with one another. And that's what happened during the Christmas Truce of 1914. I'd like to start off with a letter written by a British Tommy named Tom. And it's Christmas Day, 1914. He starts off, "My dear sister Janet, it is 2 o'clock in the morning, and most of our men are asleep in their dugouts. Yet I could not sleep myself before writing to you of the wonderful events of Christmas Eve. In truth, what happened seems almost like a fairy tale, and if I hadn't been through it myself, I would scarce believe it. Just imagine, while you and the family sang carols before the fire there in London, I did the same with enemy soldiers here on the battlefields of France. As I wrote before, there has been little serious fighting of late. The first battles of the war left so many dead that both sides have held back until replacements could come from home. So we've mostly stayed in our trenches and waited. But what a terrible waiting it's been. Knowing that at any moment an artillery shell might land and explode beside us in our trench, killing or maiming several of our fellow men. And in daylight, not daring to lift our heads above ground for fear of a sniper's bullet. In the rain, it's fallen almost daily. Of course, it collects right in our trenches, where we must bail it out with pots and pans. And with the rain has come mud, a good foot or more deep. It splatters and cakes everything and constantly sucks at our boots. One new recruit got his feet stuck in it, and then his hands, when he tried to get out, just like that American story of the tar baby. Through all this, we couldn't help feeling curious about the German soldiers across the way. After all, they faced the same dangers that we did, and slogged about in the same muck. What's more, their first trench was only 50 yards from ours. Between us lay no man's land, bordered on both sides by barbed wire, yet they were close enough that we could sometimes hear their voices. Of course, we hated them when they killed our friends, but other times we joked about them and almost felt that we had something in common. And now, it seems that they feel the same. Just yesterday morning, Christmas Eve day, we had our first good freeze. And cold as we were, we welcomed it, because at least the mud froze solid. Everything was tinged white with frost, while a bright sun shone over all. It was perfect Christmas weather. During the day, there was little shelling or rifle fire from either side, and as darkness fell on our Christmas Eve, the shooting stopped entirely. Our first complete silence in months. We hoped it might promise a peaceful holiday, but we didn't count on it. We'd been told that the Germans might attack and try to catch us off guard. I went to the dugout to rest, and lying on my cot, I must have drifted asleep. All at once, my friend John was shaking me awake, saying, come and see what the Germans are doing. I grabbed my rifle, stumbled out into the trench, and stuck my head cautiously above the sandbags. I never hoped to see a stranger and more lovely sight. Clusters of tiny lights were shining all along the German line, left and right, as far as the eye could see. What is it? I asked in bewilderment. And John answered, Christmas trees. And so it was, the Germans had placed Christmas trees in front of their trenches, lit by candles or lanterns like beacons of goodwill. And then we heard their voices raised in song. Stille Nacht, Heilige Nacht. This carol may not be familiar to us in Britain, but John knew it and translated. Silent Night, Holy Night. I've never heard one lovelier or more meaningful in that quiet, clear night, its dark softened by a first quarter moon. When the song finished, the men in our trenches applauded. Yet British soldiers were actually applauding the Germans. The Germans said, Englishmen, sing songs with us. We replied, if we sing in German, it will kill us. He replied, if you sing in German, it will kill us too. Sing in English. Then one of our own men started singing, and we all joined in. The first Noel, the angel did say, In truth, we sounded not nearly as good as the Germans with their fine harmonies, but they responded with enthusiastic applause of their own and then began another. Oh, Tannenbaum, oh, Tannenbaum. And then we replied, oh, come all ye faithful. But this time they joined in, singing the same words, but in Latin. British and German were harmonizing across no man's land. I would have thought nothing more could be amazing, but what came next was more so. Englishmen, come on over, we heard one of them shout. You no shoot, we no shoot. There in the trenches, we looked at one another in bewilderment. Then one of us shouted jokingly, no, you come over here. There in the trenches, we looked at each other. I saw one of our men lift his rifle to the ready, and no doubt others did the same. But our captain called out, hold your fire. Then he climbed out, and we went to meet the Germans halfway. We heard them talking, and a few minutes later, the captain came back with a German cigar in his mouth. We've agreed there will be no shooting before midnight tomorrow, he announced, but sentries are to remain on duty, and the rest of you stay alert. Across the way, we could make out groups of two or three men starting out of the trenches and coming towards us. Then some of us were climbing out too, and in minutes more, there we were in no man's land, over 100 soldiers and officers of each side, shaking hands with men we'd been trying to kill just hours before. Before long, a bonfire was built, and around it we mingled, British khaki and German gray. I must say that Germans were the better dressed, with fresh uniforms for the holiday. Only a couple of our men knew German, but more of the Germans knew English. I asked one of them why that was. He said, because many have worked in England. Before all this, I was a waiter in the Hotel Cecil. Perhaps I even waited on your table. Perhaps you did, I said, laughing. He told me of a girlfriend he had in London and that the war had interrupted their plans for marriage. I told him, don't worry, we'll have you beat by Easter, and then you can come back and marry that girl. He laughed at that, and then he asked if I'd send her a postcard he'd give me later, and I promised that I would. Another German had been a porter at Victoria Station. He showed me a picture of his family back in Munich. His elder sister was so lovely, and I said that I'd like to meet her someday. He beamed and said he would like that very much and gave me his family's address. Even those who could not converse could still exchange gifts. Our cigarettes for their cigars, our tea for their coffee, our corned beef for their sausage. Badges and buttons from uniforms changed owners, and one of our lads walked off with the infamous spiked helmet. That's called a pickle hoppin', by the way. I myself traded a jackknife for a leather equipment belt, a fine souvenir to show when I got home. Newspapers, too, changed hands, and the Germans howled with laughter at ours. They assured us that France was finished and Russia nearly beaten, too. He told them that that was nonsense, and one of them said, well, you believe your newspapers and we'll believe ours. Clearly, they are lied to, yet after meeting these men, I wonder how truthful our own newspapers have been. These are not the savage barbarians that we've been led to believe. They are men with homes and families, hopes and fears, principles, and yes, love of their country. In other words, they're men just like ourselves. We're Anglo-Saxons and they're Saxons. Why are we led to believe otherwise? As it grew late, a few more songs were traded around the fire, and then we all joined in for what, and I'm not lying to you, Auld Lang Syne. And then we parted, with promise to meet again tomorrow, and even some talk of a football match. I was just starting back to the trenches when an older German clutched my arm. My God, he said, why can't we have peace and I'll go home? I told him gently, you must ask your emperor. He told me and looked at me and said, perhaps, my friend, we must also ask in our hearts. And so, my dear sister, tell me, has there ever been such a Christmas Eve in all history? And what's it all mean, this impossible befriending of our enemy? For the fighting here, of course, it means regrettably little. Decent fellows those soldiers may be, but they follow orders and we do the same. Besides, we're here to stop their army and send it home, and never could we shirk that duty. Still, one can't help imagine what would happen if the spirit shown here were caught by the nations of the world. Of course, disputes must always arise, but what if our leaders were to offer well wishes in places of warnings? Songs in places of slurs? Presents in places of reprisals? Would not all war end at once? All nations say they want peace, yet on this Christmas morning, I wonder if we want it quite enough. Your loving brother, Tom.
Oh, that's wonderful. Wonderful.
And you think it was true, you know, that it's true thing?